Publishing Legends Network.
The views and opinions expressed by hosts and listeners on the Astonishing Dead Letter Office are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of Astonishing Legends Productions, the Astonishing Legends Network, or any affiliated entities or guests.
When something unexplainable happens to you, it can make you feel isolated or alone. But trust us, you're not. For over a decade, you've been sending your strange stories to Astonishing Legends. And now it's time for our fellow legenders to hear them too. Join us weekly in Blanket Fortiana as we dig through your intriguing messages to the Astonishing Dead Letter Office.
Tonight's episode, The Mennonite Girl.
Tonight, we're headed to one of the most beautiful locations in the United States, the Finger Lakes, which is a very cool area. It's made up of 11 long, skinny lakes, many miles long, 10 or 15 long, I think, in some cases, just south of Rochester, New York. These were carved by glaciers and are renowned for gorgeous waterfalls, wineries, and amazing scenery. And if you look at them on a map like Google Earth or Google Maps or whatever, it almost looks like a bear claw just scratched the earth.
Yeah, cool. Well, yeah, hence the fingers. And it's fairly well known regionally. I've certainly heard of them, but I don't take a guess as to what people have heard or know about other regions of the country.
Yes.
Well, always. It's kind of like with my dad, when my dad was, he was stationed in Virginia in the early 60s, and people ask him where he was from. He would say, oh, Washington. And they're like, oh, D.C. And he goes, no, the state. And they're like, there's a Washington state. People didn't know there.
Right.
There
right.
was a Washington state. And so there you go. But yeah, it's a beautiful area of the country, but it's meaty or weighty.
Yeah.
In a way, there's some gravitas there because you have that intersection of old world faith. You know, of course, the West Coast is not, you know, nearly, it has its own traditional history and natural gravitas to it. But the East Coast, as you well know, and the Northeast especially, has a lot of early human development.
Yes.
There's also a bit of isolation. So you think about it, it's like, oh yeah, New York, it's got to be really dense. Well, often it is. I remember being on a job and driving through, it was a little part of New Jersey. And I'm not used to this, but I was, you know, had a rental car and I'm driving from one little village, I guess you would call that. And it's like, where's the next town over? And they say, yeah, just drive up the road about a half mile. Really?
Yeah.
Like, and then you get to the next, there's no break. It's not like there's a big stretch of unused land.
Right.
It's just that you're now in another township or whatever.
Yeah.
It's like, that's weird. And then you drive another 3 or 4 miles and you're in another one. So that's odd.
Yeah.
So it's densely packed, but there's also a lot of wilderness out there. The kind of that isolation that a farmhouse at the end of a long dirt road can provide. And there's a lot of isolation. So us Westerners, we have to get our heads around that because we're used to big, wide open spaces.
Uh-huh.
And here it's like, you have that, but it's different.
Well, so more precisely, the area that we're looking at tonight is the area around Penn Yan, New York. And if you look at the map, this is tucked right at the north end of Kuka Lake. That's K-E-U-K-A. There is a large Mennonite community there, culturally adjacent to the Amish, but different. We'll talk about that in a little bit. But they do travel in horse-drawn buggies and kind of share a rejection of the modern world.
Well, there you go. And, you know, I mean, how many people have seen Witness with Harrison Ford? And that's like a lot of introduction to most folks about the Amish.
Yes,
they're pretty open, and then they sell their goods. And what their style is, for me, formulates some conclusions we'll have later, or I'll have later at the end of the story about how this could have happened. But yeah, you're talking about farmhouses that are steeped in just human and animal history.
Yeah.
And building on the land and those old ways. And, you know, it's not just wood and nails. They soak up a lot of the human energy, I believe. And, you know, when a family, when they live, they die there, they're buried on the same plot of land for generations. I think those overlays don't really have any sharp edges or boundaries on them.
Yeah.
And so I do wonder, well, we've talked about that before, when somebody sees a ghost taking the, they just went through the wall. Like they do that every time.
Yeah.
And then what's fascinating to me is like, okay, why are they doing that? Just because they can? Well,
yes.
Probably. But you might learn that the layout of the floor was different. It had been changed over the years, and that used to be a hallway.
Yeah.
Which is now a solid wall there. And so that's a natural path for them. Maybe they took in hundreds of years ago on their walkway there. So it's quite interesting. And then sometimes when you move those things,
yeah,
you might get results.
Yeah, we're all for reduce, reuse, and recycle. But when it comes to a homestead, the other re you have to keep in mind is respect, because you got to have that for those that came before you, especially. That said, tonight's dead letter is not one of oppression or anger. It's much more of an uplifting intersection between the past and the present.
Yeah, it's a nice little vignette of perhaps of days gone by. And there's no doubt that all those who've come before us can't be remembered down to the individual. Sometimes they can, I think. But it's estimated over 100 billion people have died since the dawning of our current species.
Yeah.
I guess that's not including other Cro-Magnon and other types of proto-humans.
Yes.
But yeah, there's about 8 billion people, just a little over that, on the planet right now. And then when it comes to the dead, we're outnumbered over 10 to 1. And so it makes sense that some of us continue to cross paths with them, or in this case, they're perhaps crossing paths with us. But don't you hear that argument, Scott, of like, if you have a soul, like, isn't it getting crowded? Like, maybe it is.
Yeah.
But I don't believe that everybody's here earthbound. I've come to learn in our years here is that there are specific conditions, I think, why some people have, as they say, moved on, passed on, ascended, and then some people are kind of still here for various reasons.
There you go. God, when it comes to that math, man, it's staggering. But that's the thing I always think about. It's like all the people that have come and gone along the way, and eventually that will be us. Memento mori, everybody. But anyway, I believe this dead letter is yours to read, sir, whenever you're ready.
My story took place in 1989, when my husband and I were living in Ithaca, New York. Ithaca is located in the Finger Lakes area of upstate New York at the southern end of Cayuga Lake. The area, which is dominated by a series of long, slender lakes, is famous for its wineries and gorges. There's also a big auto race held every year at Watkins Glen on the southern end of Seneca Lake, and Seneca Falls on the north end of Cayuga Lake is the birthplace of the women's rights movement. The Seneca Falls Convention, held there in 1848, resulted in the Declaration of Sentiments, which asserted women were equal to men and called for women's suffrage, as well as addressing other issues. A friend of ours, who I will call Gabe, owned an old farmhouse in Penyan, which is located on the north end of Cayuga Lake, about an hour's drive from Ithaca. The Finger Lakes area, in general, has a decent-sized Mennonite population, and this population is especially strong in Penyan. Gabe's farmhouse was quite near a couple of Mennonite farms, and his farmhouse had been the home of an extended Mennonite family at one time, and it had a small family burial plot out back. Gabe was an extremely affable man, and his friends would often gather at his house to spend the afternoon, the evening, or even the weekend. My husband and I were frequent guests there. The day I had my experience was a Sunday in early summer. A group of perhaps 6 or 8 people were visiting for a barbecue and an afternoon of leisurely card games, catch, and bird watching. After lunch, Gabe organized a walk through the fields that surrounded his house, heading for a small wooded area that eventually led to a stream and a waterfall. I didn't want to go on the walk, choosing instead to see everyone off before retreating into Gabe's living room with a book. And that's where I was about an hour later, in the rocking chair with an iced tea, some Oreos, and a copy of Slaughterhouse-Five. On the wall to my right was a window that faced the front yard of the house. On the wall opposite were 2 more windows that looked out towards the Mennonite farm across the road from Gabe's place. The left-hand window on this wall gave a clear view, but the one on the right was blocked by a lilac bush. You could see through the branches of the bush. It wasn't a solid wall, but it did obscure the view. The wall to my left was an interior wall with no windows or doors, and along that wall were a wood stove, a stack of firewood, and 2 bookcases. Behind me was another interior wall, which had doorways into the kitchen and the hall. The front door of the house opened directly into the kitchen, right behind my chair. I was thinking that I'd get up to get more tea, maybe even more Oreos,
when a movement in the left-hand window of the wall across from my chair caught my eye. 2 seconds later, a young girl passed the right-hand window. I'd say she was about 15 or 16, and she was clearly a Mennonite because she wore their distinctive white cap close to her head. Her dress was the color of purple thistles, and she was moving with purpose. Given that her pace and direction would have her rounding the corner of the house and presumably heading for the front door, I got up to go to the door and meet her. This had me leaving the living room before she passed the window on the right-hand wall, the one that faced the front of the house. I got to the front door. She wasn't there. I opened the front door and stepped out onto the porch. She wasn't there. I circled the house, looked in the woodshed, and checked behind 3 cars parked in the yard. No young woman in a vibrant purple dress. Gabe's house is surrounded by fields on 3 sides, and his front lawn, driveway, and the road are on the 4th. The vista was open in every direction. She wasn't anywhere to be seen. As I stood on the porch, feeling somewhat disquieted, the folks who had been on their walk returned. I must have looked odd because someone asked if I was okay. I explained what had happened, and people started asking the kinds of things people ask in those situations. Was I sure she was heading for the front door? Did I look in the woodshed? How did I know she was a Mennonite? Etc. But Gabe just smiled at me and said, "Oh, good. I haven't seen her in a while. I'm glad she's back." When I asked who she was, he said, "I have her gravestone in the eaves of the woodshed. The previous owner of the house broke it up to use for a walkway from the woodshed to the house, but I pulled the pieces up and put them in the shed." He said that he'd looked into the history of the house when he'd found the broken gravestone pieces, and he'd learned they belonged to a young woman who had died in the house and been buried in the family plot out back. Now, Gabe was certain that I'd seen this young woman's ghost. He said he'd seen her fairly regularly in and around the house. Obviously, he would have had a name to work with since he'd found a gravestone. Perhaps he saw a picture of her, or perhaps he just put the sightings of whatever he was seeing around the house together with the gravestone. He certainly had a number of strange things going on in that house. One weekend that I stayed there, he and I were going to go out to dinner. Now, he wanted to drive because he knew where the restaurant was. It's rural in the Finger Lakes, and you can easily drive for 10 or 15 miles on back roads to have a nice dinner. But we couldn't find his keys. We looked all over everywhere for the best part of half an hour. Finally, in the upstairs storage room, I turned to him and said, "Let's just take my car and you can co-pilot." He agreed, and we headed downstairs. There, right in the middle of the kitchen table, were his keys, where they certainly had not been before. Another time, I had called him while he was reading a magazine in the living room, in the very rocking chair where Kurt Vonnegut and I were spending time when I saw whatever I saw. This was back when there were only landlines and his phone was in the kitchen. As he was talking, he mentioned an article in the magazine he'd been reading. He put the receiver down to get the magazine. He was gone a couple of minutes, and I could hear him banging around. He came back to the phone and said the magazine, which he clearly remembered dropping into the seat of the rocking chair when he got up to answer my call, was nowhere to be found. We kept talking. As we were winding up the conversation about 15 minutes later, he stopped talking mid-sentence. Then he sort of exhaled a bit sharply and said, "Oh, okay." When I asked what was up, he said he'd just glanced into the living room and spotted the magazine. It was on the seat of the rocking chair, folded in thirds, the way we used to do with the Mad Magazine fold-ins, just sitting there on the seat of the chair, where it certainly had not been before and folded, which he certainly had not done. So, as I say, I can see why Gabe would say I'd seen the young woman who had died in the house. I just didn't feel comfortable making the same leap. But here's the thing, or things, about this young girl. First, she was solid, just as solid as you and I are. All I saw in the left-hand window was a flash of movement, but I saw her clearly in the right-hand one. She was solid. The sun bounced off her white cap and made her dress glow. She filled the window. She blocked the view, And that's the second thing. She couldn't have filled that window. The lilac bush was right in front of it, so close to the house that its branches poked into the window screen. She could never have gotten between that bush and the house. And I could never have seen her filling that window, obscuring the view from it, because the bush was in the way. If it weren't for this second thing, maybe you could talk me into the idea that I'd seen a real girl who just, I don't know, disappeared somehow. But she was in that window, between me and the road, blocking the view. The bush was not there when I saw her. So, while I don't know what she was not human.
Something strange is going on in Blanket Fortiana tonight. We'll return in moments. And now, back to the show.
Okay, this is a pretty amazing story. We're definitely going to get into some discussion here on it. But the first thing I thought we should probably do is talk a little bit about the Mennonites. So, yeah. Forrest, when we talk about this woman in the thistle purple dress and the white cap, a lot of people listening might picture them when you hear about this apparition.
Yeah, they get all the press, I think. We're getting more of it. These folks, I've run into different sects in the Northwest and parts of like, you know, Northern Idaho, Montana, and they keep to themselves. You know, they're friendly, but they don't really engage with the modern world because what good can come of that? Okay, engaging with.
Honestly, I'm envious of it. I've frequently thought about it's appealing to me. The way they live, honestly.
Well, no, it's a simpler thing. There is a lot of appeal to it. And so that's why they have the Rumspringa, I think, that young people let them decide, well, what life do you want? Do you want to keep on doing this? And so that's nice. They gave them a choice. But yeah, they would rather reject mingling too much, I think, with us deplorables and reprobates. But yeah, no, they're friendly, but they keep to themselves. And so would a young girl just kind of walk up to someone else's house? I don't think so. But let's talk about what these groups are like. Speaking of the Amish and the Mennonites.
Yes.
They're geographically close to that region, and they share some similar roots. Both groups come from the Anabaptist movement that started during the 16th century Protestant Reformation. And the core of that was the belief in adult baptism, also choosing your faith consciously rather than being baptized as an infant. See, that's some more of that egalitarianism, letting the teenagers decide, okay, have a year where you can just go wild with your wilding and whoop it up. And then you come back and you let us know, because we realize if you're raised in this and you don't feel like you have an out, maybe that's not your choice. And so as a baby, it's like you're baptized. So they let you decide.
That's super interesting. But historically, right, there are some differences though between the Amish and the Mennonites, right?
Yeah, but a lot of folks don't realize that the Amish actually splintered off from the Mennonites in 1693. So they got some history.
Okay.
And according to some cursory research, a Swiss leader named Jacob Ammann felt the mainstream Mennonite church was getting too relaxed and too assimilated into secular society. So he pushed for the strict discipline angle here, social shunning. And when the mainstream church pushed back, he broke away to form the Amish. So again, that goes to their attitude is that, they'll help you out, but like they don't want to get too mixed up in our business here because...
So theologically, that's a little like a schism, I guess, which explains the divergence in how the two groups live today. So the Amish protected their faith by drawing a very hard line between themselves and the modern world, and the Mennonites are less strict about that.
Yeah, I think that's pretty correct here. You know, that's why the Amish generally reject the public power grid, car ownership, formal education past the eighth grade. But the Mennonites, on the other hand, are incredibly diverse, but largely, you know, they will engage with the modern world.
All right. So that gives us some broader context here for Barb's dead letter. So let's talk a little bit about this story. It's a pretty fascinating story. I have a lot of questions about it. So one of the rules in most of these orders is the rule of plain fashion. So that matches what this specter may have been wearing. However, there's also the possibility there's an older order of Mennonites in this part of New York that are still dressing like that to this day. So could it have been somebody who was wandering by? That's the question you have. But like by the same token, one of the biggest issues, I think, was the fact that the apparition appeared between the bush and the window. And that particular plant or hedge, Barb made it very clear that it grows right up against the screen. But whatever thing she saw, whatever this being was that she saw, it was between that bush and the screen very clearly to her.
Yeah, that's curious. Just the literal optics of how that works and that, because I had to read that a few times to kind of get what she was saying, and very detailed description, by the way, which is great. So I can kind of picture the living room where she's sitting, but the fact that it wasn't diaphanous, see-through, she was solid, but somehow she pushed through the bush. You know what I'm saying? Like, she went between the shrubbery and the window, but it wasn't like you could see, you know what I'm saying? She would have noticed that, I think, Barb. It's like, oh, well, somehow now there's bushes going through her, you know, branches going through her. It just seemed like somehow she made her own space between the shrubs that were growing, which she said touched the screen. So they're right up against the window. There's no space, no movement of the brush. She was just there.
Yeah.
That would have been a weird thing to see, I think. And I was also knowing that there's brush, you know what I'm saying? Like, that just put a hiccup in your reality.
Yeah. And here's another thing that's interesting. Folks, we've brought this up on several Dead Letter episodes, and longtime listeners of Astonishing Legends will have heard us reference our series on Resurrection Mary, the Lady in White, women in different colors and different scenarios. It turns out that when you're talking about apparitions tied to specific properties in the Finger Lakes, Barb's Woman in Purple, for lack of a better description for her, has a lot of parallels with Ye Olde Woman in White. We have to look at one that's actually only about 15 or 16 miles from where Pen Yan is. This is over at Seneca Lake, and this is one of the most famous ghosts in upstate New York, just 15 minutes away by car, but by horse and buggy, it might take a little bit longer to get there.
So you're talking about Isabella, right?
Yes.
The Lady in White at Bellhurst Castle. And that castle sits right on the edge of the water. And as the legend goes, Isabella was an opera singer who fled to America with her forbidden lover. Always a great start to these kind of, like, something spurned, love lost, anguish, this and that, drama. Well, they built a secret underground tunnel that led straight to the lake. But during an escaped attempt, the tunnel collapsed and she was crushed.
Ooh, it's tragedy.
Yeah. Well, there you go. Yeah, the tragedy. Yeah, some lovelorn tragedy binding the person's spirit to the land there.
Yeah. And see, and then Barry Gibb pops out. He's like, tragedy. No, I can't go as high as him, but anyway.
Oh, you're okay. You didn't injure yourself, I hope.
No, I probably did. I shouldn't have even tried. But supposedly, the Lady in White at Bellhurst Castle walks the shores of Seneca Lake now in a white dress, still looking for her lover. But what's interesting is it's parallel to Barb's story with Isabella. Guests report seeing her apparition actually fly through the windows of the castle. So that's pretty cool.
Well, in both cases, you have these incredibly vibrant, solid apparitions of women tied to the 19th century architecture there. And both of them seem to have a very strange relationship with the physical boundaries of the windows and the property lines, I guess. So not just haunting a house, they are tethered geographically to the land and the water around it. Or maybe there are boundaries. It's kind of in the show Ghosts. You know, there's the manor house, but also it ends at the property line. So you can't go past. I can't remember if you bounce back or if you just, in a Michel Gondry kind of way, you find yourself just facing the other way again.
Right.
That's the rules. You can't go past the property line. That's where you cashed out. You got to stay there. Or one of my favorite characters, Nancy, who is in the part of the cholera folks that died in the cellar or the basement, and they have to stay in the basement.
Yeah.
So I don't know what the rules are, but there definitely seem to be patterns that these things follow. And this is different in that bush freaks me out in a good way. Just because, you know what I'm saying? Like I said, it's one thing if you see a ghost go through the window or they come through the wall. That's a trope. You expect that, right?
Right.
Kind of misty. They may even look solid and they go through. I don't know if whatever I saw or thought I saw at Waverly, what that was, but it appeared solid. That's why I thought it was Guy, you know?
Right. Yeah. And this thing is passing between two known physical real world, normal reality objects. It's somehow between them, even though they're flushed up against each other.
You know what I'm saying? Angle one is you were seeing objective as much as it can be, apparently, as we've been learning here the past few months, objective reality, quote unquote. And you think, well, what are the physics of that? The optical, the physical properties of seeing that, somebody passing through. But like I said, branches aren't going through them. They're not mistily miasma-like going through the brush.
Right.
It just seems like a solid-looking object. Well, as in my case with Waverly, now I doubt, like, was that just in my head that I saw that?
Right.
You know what I'm saying? Or was there something physically there outside of my head that I saw that?
Yeah.
That I perceived? Is that the case here with Barb? Is she seeing something that's physically somehow making a way through solid branches, or is she picturing that in her head? Because that is the way that, you know what I'm saying, the information has gotten to her brain. Not saying at all that she was making it up or it was her imagination and, you know, she knew the place was haunted and like, oh, you, as I think a lot of detractors would say, it's like, well, you expected to see something weird there. You're all alone. It's a spooky old farmhouse, blah, blah, blah. And you expected that, maybe you weren't totally expecting, but, you know, you'd heard Gabe before. So you were primed to see something and then you did. And then it's just your brain doing that.
Yeah. There's another kind of red flag, if you will, here. And that is probably the idea that some prior inhabitant of the home had taken the gravestone and took it apart to make a walkway.
Well,
that
seems
like downright bad idea. Not that this particular spirit did not seem threatening or frightening in any kind of way, or, you know, like we said at the top of the show, not a lot of aggression or oppression or anything going on. But I mean, just how does it sound to you, listeners of the Dead Letter Office, to the idea of taking a family gravestone on the plot of land that you're on and breaking it up and turning it into a walkway for your home?
We've talked about this a lot on the show in the past because this is not a new idea or a new trend. The Romans were doing it, and the term for that is spolia, you know, like spoilage or the spoils of war, the spoils of rebuilding. And it's hard to come up with those materials on your own, especially for free when it's sitting right there. So
And it's already been worked in some kind of complex, labor-intensive way. It's already been worked, so you've got a shortcut to using it for your new purpose.
That's the big thing is like you got planks. It's like, look, I want to build a new cabin and there's that old miner's shack over there and there's already planks. I don't have to plane them or mill them.
Yeah.
I'll just tear that down and use them for my building. It's like it's reusing, it's upcycling, whatever you want to call it. Yeah, but it's still pretty disrespectful. And so, and here's the thing. There's also history loaded of fallout. The one that comes to mind now is when we were talking about the Hellfire Club.
Just to add some context to what Forrest is saying, there is a, or was a real Hellfire Club, which we talked about during our Loftus Hall series, right?
That's
Wasn't it Loftus Hall?
Yeah.
This is not the one from Stranger Things, although the one in Stranger Things is probably named for the real one.
Of course.
Just making it clear, we're not talking about Stranger Things
here. I never got that far in the series.
I did, and I loved it. And that guy, the actor was amazing. All that was amazing. But we're talking about the real Hellfire Club.
No, this is historically, and yes, it is tied, and that's stumbling upon a new thing.
Yeah.
That's one where I dug further down into it because people were wondering if there was a connection between the families or the history of Loftus Hall.
Yeah, the building's still the there on a hill outside of Dublin, right?
Right. And so that's notoriously haunted, a lot of shadow figures, creepy, bad vibes, this and that. And I think it was the mantle place that was spoliated from headstones and other, you know, mausoleums and stuff nearby.
Right.
And so that's adds to the lore of that. But yeah, it's like, I think what people do that are the type of people who don't believe at all in ghosts. And it's like, well, who cares? They're gone. Well, they're just in
they
the
don't
ground.
Need
they're not coming.
Or
yeah, they
Eddie
don't need
Murphy.
It. They're not coming back.
You won't
back.
Be needing these shoes anymore.
There's a fascinating series on Instagram where a guy who cleans old headstones and he's got a ovulus or he's either got the, you know, what they call the Shack Hack, the Radio Shack radio, and it's spitting out words.
Oh, yes.
And they're very in context. Like I said, very non-random. Like Mark's cleaning and it's like, that's the guy's name. And he's like, yep, I'm cleaning. And he's just very nonchalantly like, oh, yep, I'm cleaning your headstone. You're welcome. And he gets talked to, apparently, if you believe that, from the spirits nearby. So some are still in the, and they appreciate you touching that up, not breaking it up to make a walkway when you could just go to Home Depot.
Right. And I mean, this actually goes back to one of our very, very, very early shows too. I always think about also Oak Island. And they were taking stuff that they were bringing up that had context and clues on it, and then repurposing it to doorsteps and things.
That's
like that.
The 90-foot stone. And so they take this thing. It's got all this kind of strange markings, and it was backing the fireplace of somebody. I can't remember who in the story, but they put it in the back of the fireplace. Like, isn't there already stone there? Like bricks, at least fire brick. But no, they thought it would like be decorative. And then it was at a local gift shop, like holding the door open. And there you go. One of the key pieces of Oak Island lore and the big clue to the big mystery and other people, it's a doorstop.
Yeah.
And, you know, like I said, if you just imagine if you could have just bought that. But like, yeah, again, it's just not caring.
Anyway, that's one of those things that just like, okay, we're repurposing things. Is there ill intent here or is it just practicality? I don't know. The other thing that's interesting about this story, though, is the apportation, right? Because Barb talks about the keys that go missing and then they turn up. And then the magazine, and then it's there in the chair. And also, she mentioned specifically the Mad Magazine fold-in, which a lot of people probably won't remember. There was an artist named Al Jaffe.
That's right.
I'm pretty sure has probably passed away, because I know he was like 90 back in the 2011 or 10 or something. And he did these famous like illustrations where like when it was opened out, it looked like benign. And then you would get the joke when you would fold the outer quarters in and it would turn like a swimming pool turns into a toilet.
Yeah, it's a visual puzzle gag. And so the paper was folded in on itself, like you would have perhaps if you had a 8.5 by 14 legal size piece of paper and you wanted to get it into a folder, you fold it up. So then you could pull it out to see the whole thing, but also doesn't stick out past the rest of the pages. So for the magazine, it was folded over. So you saw the short gag. And then the joke was when you pulled it out, I think, is that then you see the whole picture.
Right, which is not necessarily what was happening here with the magazine in this case, but the fact that she described it being folded in this very precise way, I think is interesting. The other thing I was thinking about with the keys, it's like the keys were lost, but then they turned up. Yeah. And this is one of those cases where with apportation and missing stuff and ghostly hauntings and what have you, you're like, is this spirit or this thing that might be involved in this stuff, is it taking these things and then returning them when you ask for them? Or is it helping you find stuff you lost? It's like, no, I did lose the keys. Well, I know where those were. I'm going to put them in the middle of this table that you just looked for them 10 minutes ago. Yeah. I didn't take them, but I saw them on the floor in the kitchen or whatever.
Right,
and I didn't take the magazine. It slid down in the chair cushions. So I'm going to pull it out and put it right here. And just so you know I did it, I'm going to do this weird origami with it.
No. I don't know what that was about, other than like, Kilroy was here, kind of marking your territory. Yeah. But I think it can be both. It can be a playful thing, a trickstery kind of thing, just a playful thing of like hiding something and then taking it. And I think sometimes it can be helpful when you're looking for something and then they pop up. And then I love the middle option, which is expressed in the movie The Sixth Sense. And towards the end.
No spoilers.
No, but the idea is that at the beginning, I think Toni Collette's character he's like, what are you doing with my bee pendant? I can't find it. I want to wear it. So it's just, you know, obviously she's annoyed. It keeps missing. And she doesn't know what the reason is. I think Haley Joel does, because he's talking with grandma. So towards the end, and it's one of my favorite moments in cinema ever. It's so touching and it chokes me up every time, but he's talking with his mother and explaining his abilities. I see dead people, all that, the famous trope. And then he's relaying or trying to prove also that he can communicate with her mother, his grandmother, who's passed. And she goes, you know, that's not right. That's not healthy. You shouldn't be able to do that. And then he kind of tells her some anecdotes. And one, he goes, grandma wants to let you know that she's sorry about taking your bee pendant. She doesn't mean to be annoying, but she just likes it. So it's inadvertent in that she just, to grandma's spirit, she's just picking it up and holding it for a bit, but it goes missing in the world of the living.
Right.
It's a reverse apportation. It's going somewhere to the other side, perhaps, or she's not really hiding it unintentionally. She's just holding on to it. She likes it. It's got a lot of fond memories. And then she puts it back, and because there's no time, it's like, oh, there's a week that's gone by or a day, and I wanted to wear it last week. Oh, I'm sorry. I just want to look at it. So it's kind of unintentional. Perhaps. And like I said, it's just that kind of misstep here between the two worlds.
Yeah. It's fascinating when you think about it and like where these objects are coming and going and is the manipulation. And that's another thing you hear with some medians, and granted, sometimes they're cold readers, but like sometimes there are people that are doing unexplainable things. And there seems to be this connection between objects that are left between, you know, from deceased family members to their descendants. And it's like they mean something, and it's never in support of materialism. It's more in support of the emotional connection through the object from the living to the dead or vice versa.
Yeah. That never goes away, I believe. And that's why I like the anecdote in the Skoll experiments when they were apporting objects. It's like, hey, we didn't steal these things. Okay. It's like,
right.
There's a lot of objects out there that are just lost. Imagine the world and the earth and the dirt is just full of them.
Yeah.
People dropping something that's memorable, but they produce things that had some meaning or connection or tried to with the person, the live person they were interacting with.
All right. Well, one last question here, man, as we wrap up. Do you think that this is a case of, because here, frankly, for me, I don't see this as being just a stranger, a local Mennonite person wandered across the front porch of this house. I don't think that's what this is. I think this is a spiritual being. But, you know, if we're going to believe this story, then to me, it feels like an actual spirit or a ghost. And then again, that thing of it passing between the bush and the screen, which reminds me of that one story of the bipedal wolf dude that turned and became a straight line, was one dimensional. Like, how do you get between these two things? Or what are you doing to reality to appear between these two things? I'm a little bit of a broken record on that, but I'm really fascinated with it. So my question to you is, do you think that Barb saw perhaps an echo of the past, someone from the past somehow connected to the property or the family that had the property before and had lived there all those years? Or maybe it comes into another category that we've been covering more and more lately, a time slip of some kind.
Well, first of all, if we explore the mundane angles to it, that it's a live human person. And to me, there's two immediate things to go to. One is that it's an actual Mennonite girl living nearby. And the other one is that it's not a Mennonite girl, but it's a young girl playing a prank. Right?
Right.
So those are the two most obvious. It'd be weird. Like, no, I always dress like this. I just really lost. Okay. That's maybe the third thing. I don't buy that. So that's not worth entertaining. But take the first option where it is an actual Mennonite girl who lives nearby. First, it would be a long ways away, I think, to be on foot. She didn't drive over there, although apparently that's not against the rules, But as far as what we've been discussing about the behaviors of the Mennonite, they would not come on a stranger's property like that close to the house.
Right.
If there was something they needed, hey, there's an emergency, or, you know, someone's hurt up the road. Could I, you know, use your phone? Can you come help? They are in needing of help. I think they would have gone straight to the front door, or at least remain there.
Right.
Okay. So that's the thing, is if she were an actual Mennonite person, but it would be an emergency situation. Not trespassing, not poking around somebody else's house. That does not track for me at all.
Yeah, I agree.
The second thing is that it's a long walk, literally for a joke, to play a prank on somebody. It wasn't somebody from the other group doing that. Also, wouldn't you wait until there were more people in the house if you were going to play that prank to cause a ruckus, rather than make one person, you know, look like they're crazy, perhaps?
My thing, too, is in this day and age, particularly in this country, I think going onto a stranger's porch, you're running a legitimate risk of coming to grievous harm.
More so, back in the old days. I think I've said this a few times. And again, looking at my own ancestors and relatives, it is, especially back here. Now, I don't know about these communities that are also more genteel, perhaps, and established in the Northeast, but out in the Old West, I can tell you that my grandmother, great-grandmother, nicest, sweetest, most generous person ever. But back in the day, I remember out camping with her, and, you know, there's people nearby, and they're probably playing More Than a Feeling, Boston, or you know, just like,
right.
And being a little annoyed at that, but like,
this is how I feel about loud music on the beach. People bring in speakers than just blasting something like 20
for all of us. Thank you. But I think we were just talking about, you know, camping out in the old days. And she said, you don't walk up on another person's campsite, you know, especially if you're out on the trail with horses out in the middle of nowhere. You stop at a distance and you state your intentions.
That's right.
You walk up at somebody's camp, you surprise them, you might get ventilated.
Yep.
And she's not talking about a nice, cool fan breezed. But yeah, remember in True Grit, it's like, state your intentions. It's like, that's intend to shoot all of you within 1 minute. So that was that's an old fashioned term, but like that was really done. He's like, you stop, you state your intentions. It's like, I'm here to harm you, or hey, I ran out of food. Can you spare any? Or I need directions. But you stop. You don't come up on somebody's camp like that, and you don't come up to somebody's house like that, unless it's an emergency. Then, like I said, you stick around. You're at the front door. You're not poking around because, people, they don't know what you want. So I don't think that the human angle here is very likely, especially you rush outside and there's no one there and there's nowhere for them to have disappeared to, right? It's not a bunch of thick brush or this and that.
Yeah.
Okay, the mundane doesn't really add up for me. And then if you're asking, well, what if she was a spirit? Well, now I've come to believe there are several different varieties, right? And one could be the echo of seeing somebody. The other strange thing is, like, there's a great photo, and some folks I'm sure would dismiss it, but it's on a stage. Somebody's taking a picture of the stage where there's little kids doing a performance, and it's like during a rehearsal. So it's kind of informal. They're all sitting down, and there's a dancer, an older woman, you know, the kids are grade school age. She's looks like she's in her 20s, and it looks like she's doing a twirl, and she looks solid, except that her legs fade out.
Oh, yeah.
Like they just fade into nothing, and somebody just happened to snap it, and there she is. I'm not sure if the person taking the photo even saw her, but like that's a partial apparition or a partial, and whatever rules going on there, she may have been an echo of dancer in the past. We've talked a lot about our friend Marty and his wife Alice in the Queen Mary and what he feels just on his gut feeling. And I come to believe, you know, that it wasn't so much a ghost. It was more like an echo of somebody who'd stayed in that room in the past and it didn't interact with him. It could be something like that. Again, it was occupied. I think the farmhouse had been there for a very long time. So maybe they lived there. I do wonder about the footprint of the farmhouse and the location. Like, where would she have come from? Where did she live when she was alive? And was it just something that she did all the time? And so we're seeing an echo of past behavior or a spirit. And again, I'm not going to set the rules on this. It's like, well, if she was a human live soul spirit, then she would have been partially materialized and you would have seen the brush through her. We certainly heard a lot of explanations and descriptions like that, where somebody was partially formed, but still misty or tinged blue or white or this and that. And we've heard, talks about people like, it looked like a real person, totally solid, totally there. I don't know what that is. And then the third thing is like a time slip. I always think go back to this story. A woman had written in about being kind of like a volunteer curator, I think in Texas, and it was a small train museum with different train cars and like the old Pullman cars. And they dressed up in late 1800s, Texas attire and dresses, talking about that. They were on a break or a shift of duties. And so she said, well, why don't you go check, just clear out that one car because we're going to have another tour group coming in. Like, okay. And she goes in there and she's dressed in period dress. And she goes in there and there's four guys also sitting in the parlor in the car, also dressed. And she's like, that's weird. Like you some weird reenactment group. Like, well, you're not supposed to be here.
Right.
And I think she was stunned that they were, because she never saw anybody come in or go out. Now, here's my favorite part of the story. She comes into the car and they all turn and look at her. And I think either they gave her a look of dismissal, like, don't bother us, little lady, get out of here. Or they said something to that effect, like, don't bother us. We'll call you if we need you, or just, get out of here for right now.
Yeah, yeah.
They were annoyed that their conversation was interrupted, but they interacted with her. She's like, oh, okay, that's weird. Maybe she went to go get her supervisor. And then they were just gone. So that seems like a weird time slip where they're just overlaid in a place where the train used to be in operation.
Yeah, yeah.
But there's an interaction there where like she, and also she didn't appear weird to them. She looked like someone of the time. But it's like, well, look, you're not the conductor. Like, just leave us alone while we're chatting. Well, the men are talking. And so they were kind of dismissive. And she's like, that's weird. But also I remember Brad Steiger in one of his books talking about growing up in it wasn't a farmhouse. It was an old converted Pony Express station, that would have stables and a small ranch style house attached to it. And it was totally haunted. But as a kid, he said that the spirits there would talk to him. So they're very interactive. It wasn't a time slip. He said, to his mind, they were ghosts, but they were always chatting with him as a little kid, and he could see them clearly.
You never know.
You never know. And so anyway, here is like, yeah, there's no interaction. I'm not sure that the spirit or apparition was aware of the person inside, but I think that they were doing everything that they did in life as a young girl. I don't think it had to be tragic. I don't think like the other lady's spirit where a tunnel collapsed on her might be just a picture of daily life as a Mennonite back in the day.
Well, Barb, it's one thing to hear a floorboard creak or see a shadow out of the corner of your eye. It's quite another to see someone so vibrant and solid they block out the afternoon sun, only to realize they were standing in a space that in our time was already occupied by a bush or a hedge, as Dudley Moore would say. It makes you wonder how many people are walking through our living rooms right now, just a few decades out of sync. Well, we want to thank Barb for sharing such a vivid account from the Finger Lakes region of the country. It's a place we hadn't had a story from before. Thank you for sending your letter into the Astonishing Dead Letter Office.
The Astonishing Dead Letter Office is hosted by Scott Philbrick and Forrest Burgess and is executive produced by Tess Feifel. The show is edited and mixed by Sarah Voorhees-Wendell at VW Sound. The theme is based on the Astonishing Legends theme by Judson Crane at Founder Music, arranged by Alan Caricia, who composes all the other music in the show. Tommy Beaver Design created the logo. The announcer is John Bowman. That's me. Stories are lightly edited for length, content, and readability, but otherwise presented as they're sent to us. We're always looking for more dead letters, so if you have a story of your own you'd like to share, email it to deadletteroffice@astonishinglegends.com. Please include how you would like to be credited. First name only, first name last initial, anonymous, a pseudonym. Let us know. Due to the number of emails coming in, we often cannot respond, but we do read them all. No part of this show may be reproduced anywhere without permission. Copyright Astonishing Legends Productions.